to discover you might want about today, we're going to have a great talk by Kerry Boone. Kerry Boone is a fellow in our fellows program, and I've been looking around, I'm seeing quite a number of fellows, and I'm seeing quite a number more fellows. I've already tried to twist Pete's arm to apply next year anyway. So if you're not a fellow of our fellows program, you might be one. And so you can get in touch with us about that. Okay, so Kerry, who is she? So I see UC Santa Cruz, and let me say, and she studied there for her BA in food systems and social change. Wow. Now that is a subject matter, I like it, in the community studies department, all right? And then after that, and it's actually not so clear what you did after that, but she worked for 8 years in Central America and Mexico as a student program developer and as now as an action researcher, which I really like. So she's registered here in the sociology department as a master's student, and she's going to talk to us today about tackling climate change, food sovereignty, and home gardens in northern Nicaragua. And I know I'm the only one in the room that always has to have food sovereignty, you know, to find it again and again and again. She has done it about 10 times, but I'm hoping she'll do that as well. And so we're extremely lucky to have her here today. And so she'll hold forth, and then we'll have a good discussion afterwards. And thank you so much.
Very cool. Okay.
So apparently they're recording me and how many times they say
No pressure.
It actually counts up how many ums, and at the end it shows it on the screen.
Okay, cool. Great. Well, first of all, thanks everyone for coming. This is awesome surprise to see you all out here and interested in the research I've been doing for the last few years, but also for the last, like she said, 8 years I've been working in different NGOs in Guatemala and one based in Santa Cruz, where I had the opportunity to visit and do program development in all sorts of different countries in Central America and Mexico. So this research is sort of a culmination of not just my research over the summer, but also those years that I've spent working in this field. So I was invited by a research team to come participate as a visiting researcher in a long-term food security and food sovereignty project. I'll define that term in just one moment. and they are looking at the projected impacts of climate change in the Central American region, and in particular this region of Nicaragua, which is right on the northern border with Honduras, this little green area there. And there's some pretty sort of worrisome projections in terms of food production in the area. So the goal of this presentation is sort of to give like a snapshot of like the on-the-ground realities, what's going on and in the northern highlands in Nicaragua, and also sort of the process of development at the development project and how farmers are thinking about and how organizations are thinking about the process of community development. So there'll be some research findings and stuff like that, but I also just wanted to bring this like picture of what's going on there and the process that I went through to do the research. So, hold on a minute. So the larger project is working with a project team of a Nicaraguan NGO, a second level coffee cooperative, a research team of participatory action researchers as they identify, and 18 base level coffee cooperatives. The map on the right there are the 18 different co-ops and the little yellow dots there in three different departments of Nicaragua. So that's sort of the research site that I was working in. And they're, like I mentioned, sort of looking for strategies to address these impacts of climate change. So this is that same region. And on the left is sort of the region of suitability for growing coffee. And coffee is one of the main income sources for most of the families. And in lots of cases, the only income source in terms of financial money. And so additionally, there's also most farmers rely on subsistence farming of corn and beans as part of their livelihoods. So this is from the International Center of Tropical Agriculture. There's also been various other UN reports and World Bank reports projecting it, that the climate change will have dramatic impact on the production of coffee and staple crops. So the actuals on the left, the green part, is the land, the arable land that is ripe for coffee growing. I should mention that coffee is a very sort of special crop. It requires very particular temperatures and rainfall and soil conditions and management practices, particularly like Arabica coffee, like the stuff we all love to drink, needs a very particular altitude, high altitude coffee. So this is what it is right now, and by 2050 they're projecting that the picture on the right will be the actual suitability region. So that has a lot of people concerned, and the NGOs that I was working with, as well as governments and international institutions, are very concerned about food insecurity in this region. So I mentioned, you know, for the coffee as well as the staple crops. Bean production has actually already decreased in this region. It's no longer at its sort of maximum potential yield. And they're really concerned about corn. So my particular research that I worked on was around home gardens. And home gardens, I'll sort of explain and define in a little bit, but the initial questioning came from the research team that I was collaborating with, and they were originally interested in the relationship between agrobiodiversity of home gardens, so like vegetables and all sorts of diverse garden, and food security, household food security. And so I developed some really great, sexy methods. I had all these participatory knowledge mapping and mapping out of garden, participatory mapping of gardens and in-depth interviews and life histories. And I had about 25 pages, Pete saw it, about 25 pages of these great methods. And I went there and I was like, yeah, I'm prepared. You know, I worked with the researchers and I get there and there's like, I presented it to the project team, which was the Nicaraguan NGO, the second level co-op, and some nutritionists and some other people that are involved in the larger 18 cooperative project. And they're like, that's great, yeah, agrobiodiversity, cool, but what we really want to know is why don't farmers just change? Like, why don't they just, why don't they just adapt and change their habits, start home gardens, they know how to do it, why wouldn't they just do it on their own? Why, you know, why do NGOs have to give out seeds? Why, you know, it was sort of this, the way I took it at the time was this, like, very individualistic attitude of, like, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, improve your livelihood. And at first, you know, I thought about this for a while, I was like, wow, that's really, you know, sort of like, do they understand, like, these larger social processes of the market forces and, you know, the Revolutionary War that completely depleted the economy and, you know, all these sorts of, like, socio-historical economic larger forces that have had an impact on farmers' options in the region. And so I didn't say that, but I thought that, and I was like, wow, I can answer this question. And so the question became more sort of the agrobiodiversity piece sort of got cut out. And they were more just like, if home gardens are an effective strategy to reach food security. That, okay, that's my question. Their question was the second one, is why farmers may be resistant to changing their food production and consumption strategies. I better move this a little bit faster. This is just the organizations that were involved. From the far right, it's the NGO and the second level co-op. These are CAN and GMCR2 funding organizations, and the researchers were sort of under the umbrella of CAN as well as their home academic institution. So these are sort of the players along with the 18 co-ops that I showed earlier. So once I had met with the project team and got the questions, I developed the interview questions and the larger question obviously with the project team, and then I sort of got the okay to go out and meet with the different base level cooperatives and the farmers. So I would meet at each cooperative, I would meet with the consejo or the council, the cooperative council, who sort of the decision-making, democratic decision-making body in the community. And I proposed the different questions and the research, and most of them were like, yeah, great, you know, what sounds good, here's the people you can talk to, and, well, I should talk about my sampling strategy, but I'll hold off on that. And one thing I just want to point out, the two men, gentlemen on the left, are sort of another layer to people involved in this project, which they're called promoters. And they're often, it's not a new phenomenon by any means, but oftentimes used in as intermediaries between NGOs and the community, or between agronomists or technicians and the communities. And at this point, they're intermediaries. That's not necessarily the vision of what promoters can do. They're community members. They grew up in the community. They know the socio-historical context. They can, in a lot of ways, represent community needs to the larger different programs and projects going on. And the idea is that they play a leadership role in the development, community development initiatives in the community. So I just wanted to point them out, I guess mostly because usually I've seen them quite often in Central America and Mexico in terms of a red flag for a participatory development project. And there's some stuff written about them. And I think they're just sort of, it's sort of an important phenomenon and mechanism to think about when we think about participatory development. So in terms of the, you know, after meeting and whatnot and my methods, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I did just want to state sort of epistemologically where I'm coming from. I fall under the naturalist research paradigm, and that is, I want to say this because I know there's tons of different, fields and departments in here, and I just want to clarify where I'm coming from in terms of the methods that I use, and that under the naturalist paradigm, it's believed that reality constantly changes, and that you can't really know directly what someone's reality is, right? And so you can only understand through interactions of people and how they respond to each other and how they create their own reality. So that means we sort of accept the possibility that there are multiple versions of reality. There's no, in contrast to maybe like a positivist philosophy, there's no one truth. There, you can't just, you know, there's no fixed, measurable, knowable one reality. And so this is important for understanding how farmers make the world around them and how they make decisions, because they make decisions on the way they perceive reality. And it gives us a lot of insights into their behaviors and decision makings, and I mean, not just farmers, but anywhere you apply this sort of paradigm. Finally, Robin. I tried to get in there earlier, I just couldn't do it. Okay, so food sovereignty is a really large, overarching, convoluted term that I'm going to try and break down in more simplistic terms as much as possible. So the idea arose historically out of people's and producers' and farmers' discontent with the way the food system is being run. So not having control or decision-making over their lands, their environments, the direction they take their culture. So food sovereignty is sort of a movement or an agenda to reclaim the control and decision-making over food systems. It implies structural changes, which is something that makes a lot of people sort of uneasy to think about, because we're talking about sort of bigger, larger changes. What else do I want to say about that? I guess one, it's So I get, when I talk about structural changes, by the food sovereignty sort of agenda, it's viewed as a strategy to resist and in a lot of ways dismantle the current sort of agribusiness corporate run food regime. And when I say that and considering food sovereignty in general, it is considered sort of an ideal type. It's this vision of where we could be or where we could go, and it's a way, something that you can base decisions on when you're thinking about how we reconstruct the food systems and the choices that people have within it. And it, I often get this question, well, what's food security then? What about food security? How does that fit in? And I just briefly want to touch on it, you know, basically, so I don't throw too much stuff at you guys, is just, you know, food security, it's a little more intuitive. It's sort of like, you know, people having enough healthy access to enough healthy foods to meet their caloric needs on a daily basis in a culturally appropriate way. So the food security agenda is sort of what has been traditionally implemented in different communities as a way to get people enough food. And in a lot of ways, according to food sovereignty literature and frameworks, it has, in a lot of ways, it emphasizes the maximizing of food production. So for those people who know Malthus, this is sort of his philosophy that, you know, if we just produce more and more food, people will have more to eat, right? But it's it also forgets to mention about how, where, and by whom the food is produced. So I think, you know, there's tons of studies done, for example, where there was plenty of food in the area, but people were starving. Mm-hmm. So it becomes more of a question of distribution. Moving along, this is a picture of a home garden. On the left is a drawing that's about an acre big, and you see the different X's and stars and circles, and that represents sort of the diversity of different plants and bushes, trees, coffee, cacao, bamboo. This is in a different region, actually, of Nicaragua. The actual gardens that I was more focused on tend to be more up here towards the household, and it's the vegetable growing area. So we have this really broad, big agro biodiverse picture, and then the garden is sort of closer to the household, and that's significant for a lot of reasons that I'm going to talk about. But on the right, it's just sort of interesting to see how organized home gardens actually are. Although they're taking place over this big area, they're actually usually partialed out into different management zones. And within each management zone, they grow different, right, different crops. So, and they have different purposes. And so it's this very, you know, when I say home garden, sometimes people are like, oh yeah, like my garden in my backyard that has a few tomatoes. And I'm like, no. These are serious. These are some, like, very well planned out, very, you know, people tend to subsist or rely on these for survival. So it's a little bit different than, you know, than what some people have perceived. Okay, so back to the placement of the vegetable garden. It's significant for a few reasons. One is that it's, because it's near the household, it tends to be a female space, which means that, it tends to be a female space, so that means that the woman of the house, who tends to stay around, care for the children traditionally, manages it, makes decisions around it, saves seeds from it. Any leftover vegetables that the house doesn't consume is sold on the market, which offers an income to women that is often managed by the male counterpart in the relationship. So it does have these socioeconomic opportunities with it. And so I think this is, I pretty much said that. So these are sort of different characteristics. Medicinal, there's on average 70 species within a home garden. Medicinals, fruit trees, ornamentals. In my particular case, the home garden was being promoted as a diet diversification strategy within the food security, food sovereignty agenda, which is relevant for some reasons I'll get into. So I don't know, this may have been sort of implied in my last slide, but I just sort of wanted to put out there, you know, why home gardens and why food sovereignty is the idea that we farmers can control productive resources. And in very historically lack of, or when historically they have had very little control over their food systems for various reasons. So these are some initial preliminary research results of my last summer's research. First of all, you know, so why don't farmers change their habits, change and employ home gardens? And one thing I one finding is that people think markets work better. They would prefer to plant more coffee, for example, and perhaps coffee is easier to manage once you already have sort of the monocropping system going, and it's, you know, plant more coffee and use the income to purchase food instead of doing the subsistence style. Another finding around altering food habits. So I mentioned that, you know, this was sort of pitched as a way to diversify diets and increase, you know, decrease visits to the doctor and have a more healthy consumption habit. And in Nicaragua, they have a relatively, is maybe what, you know, at least I would consider an undiversified diet. Corn, beans, rice, tortillas, some onions and garlic and, you know, some peppers and stuff like that, but not a whole large diversity like maybe we're used to here. And so not when we talk about home gardens, we're also implying that they're going to eat food, right? So if we're talking about diverse vegetable garden and they're not used to consuming vegetables, then it doesn't, you know, it's not going to be an easy sell. And that sort of leads into the next one around historically, culturally, farmers consume certain things, certain staple crops that they were raised to eat and raised to learn, you know, how to grow and, you know, how to deal with pests and how to save the seed of and all these things that, you know, they're just sort of ingrained in and how they consume.
How much time do I have? 25,
And then the other question that kept coming up was sort of who says that farmers want to be food sovereign, and that's really important given that within the definition of sovereignty is that farmers have the power to choose how much they want to integrate into the markets and how much they want to participate in this agenda. And I think I came in during my visits and conversations with farmers. I had, you know, it was the sort of stereotypical common interaction where, you know, I'd go and sort of talk with them and get their input and then be like, okay, so are you going to give us seeds or, you know, sort of what do we get out of talking with you? And they knew that I came from the larger food security project and we're just sort of like, so, you know, like, we'll do this sort of if you can provide us with the seeds. Seeds are very expensive in Nicaragua, and so buying like a thing of seeds can be kind of unreasonable in some poorer communities. So it was not unfounded by any means, but it just sort of, you know, that kept happening. Is sort of getting that sort of wanting seeds, and then you know, we're sort of getting, feeling that not only sort of what they said, but also that feeling of this, you know, being a white person from an international place where I'm coming in and asking them what they think about stuff. And it's been happening for a long time, right? So international development and aid in this region is very common. It's most people depend on outside organizations for basic social services, and especially since Reconstruction after the Revolutionary War, it's sort of been this influx of NGOs. So there is this long history of northern-based countries directing development projects. And that was very apparent in my interactions with farmers. And it was sort of these expectations. And it led to this phenomenon that is nothing new. It's this concept called development discourse. And I'll talk a little bit more about it. But it's really becoming a foundation of the way I'm interpreting and seeing the inhibiting factors of home gardens. So in a lot of ways, farmers make decisions not to participate in food sovereignty agendas, and it's a form of resistance to these processes of change defined by project decision makers. And that's, it sort of was like, yeah, of course, if people are used to sort of these top-down projects coming in and speaking in a certain language and sort of offering certain things, they're going to, I'm sort of not explaining this very well. I'll move on and come back to that. So this idea of development discourse, which was developed by Arturo Escobar, he's a post-development theorist, I suppose, and he talks about this discourse. And I'm sort of looking at this, I should just back up a minute. The idea of home gardens was actually brought up in the democratically run assemblies within the cooperatives, right? So farmers voted on, we want to do home gardens. And so it was sort of expected strategy, but also voted on, right? So they're buying into this. Yet the question is, like, why wouldn't farmers just develed their home gardens on their own without support? And, if they understand the benefits, which they clearly did through my interviews, they understand the benefits of home gardens, why wouldn't they just do it on their own? So back to this development discourse. The idea is that development has been a primary mechanism through which particularly Central America has been produced, and has the ways they have produced themselves. So in some ways, by this known, well-known and expected interactions with NGOs and other organizations and agronomists and whatnot, there's sort of this discourse that's expected, these products that are expected from development projects. There's even this, language that I don't know if people here have worked in different countries with development, but there's this particular language that you use when you're speaking as part of a project or an organization, and this really became apparent to me, because when I would go and talk with a farmer, he might start talking in sort of his native and comfortable tongue, using slang, words I didn't really understand, and then he'd be like, oh yeah, okay, and he'd switch to this discourse that was I consider like an organizational language. And so you're sort of limited to certain words, and by being limited to certain words in like a certain lexicon or vocabulary, it in some ways limits the way you can perceive problems and the way you can develop solutions to them, right? Because you're sort of limited into this certain way of thinking by the way you speak. And so that's sort of inhibits thinking of new actions. And this particular discourse, it's ingrained in not only farmers, but also the organizations and different community organizations that are involved in development in this community. So for those who like theory, that second thought is a little, I want to get into it. So what I'm arguing is that home gardens as a development strategy that relies on this sort of discourse that is embedded in farmers and organizations and having sort of products at the end of development projects and sort of having these very ingrained trajectories and languages that is known it's going to inhibit a food sovereignty agenda, because food sovereignty agenda demands that we rethink the food system and that we come up with new solutions. And this is one of... This was... To do that, there are methods, you know. This has been thought about for a long time, right? So participatory action research is at the core of the project I was working with, right? And the researchers I work with understand this process, but they're also coming up to face-to-face with this discourse from the organizations they're working with and the farmers that are used to, you know, this way of doing things. So just sort of briefly, this is sort of, even if you don't see, you know, can read all this or whatever, the main point is that there is a process. There is a process that happens that is not necessarily concerned with an end final product of a home garden development, for example. And it starts with describing, reflecting, acting, and sharing. And And also crucially, that the idea is that the farmers are at the center of this, and that researchers or other people will just facilitate instead of direct this process. So this is sort of the ideal in terms of a process and empowering way of doing community development. This, and I hope this isn't confusing, I'll walk through this real quick. This is sort of what it looks like right now. This is a snapshot of what it looks like in the project I was working in. So over here you sort of have the funders, and they're mostly talking with the research team, and that's where the funding gets channeled through there, right? So and then we have the second level co-op and Nicaraguan NGO and the farmers. So a few things you might notice, you know, paying attention to the arrows and the way they're facing. There's the researchers are playing an advising role, but they're also filtering products and information through to the second level co-op and the NGO. The funders actually play they're sort of off to the side, and although they do have to approve the proposal for funding, right? So in some way they do have a lot of control in some ways. But once they do that, they don't play a huge role in the day-to-day sort of decision making. But they do help set the agenda. So there's the research team, and their research team is advising and working with the NGO and the second level co-op. Information and reports and knowledge is going both directions in that sense. But then when we get over here to the farmers, right, which ultimately, based on the last cycle that I showed you, should be sort of at the center of decision making and instead we have a lot of information and resources going to the farmers, but not a whole lot coming out. And that's, you know, this is a very simplistic way of representing that, but I think it's really important for a lot of reasons, and especially in terms of having successful things, right? So it's not that the researchers don't understand that this is happening. They understand this top-down nature that's going on, but they themselves as action researchers can't come in and tell the NGOs, you need to do this, this, and this, and make it participatory, right? They're dealing with years and years, decades of top-down projects, that sedimentation of experiences that, you know, it's very structural, and it's what people know and are used to, and so they're up against a really big challenge. They are... I got like 10 minutes.
10 or 15.
There are some alternatives. And in particular, there's one that's a farmer-to-farmer exchange, and it's one that the larger project is working very hard to integrate into their strategies. This is nothing new. It started in the 1970s, and I've heard two different things in northern Guatemala, southern Mexico, but it's been around since at least the 70s. And the idea is that it creates a social process where farmers are able to share their knowledge and experiences between each other, sort of an experiential knowledge share. And it depends on, this process and this structure depends on local knowledge and ingenuity versus sort of the outside technician or maybe even the nationally urban educated technicians and agronomists. And so I'm sort of wondering, can a model like this offer direction to overcome that development discourse that I mentioned and help still steer more collaborative conservation? So I can just briefly give you the overview of this because I know it's a lot of stuff. But so if on the left is what is currently the traditional way, conventional communication model, when we're talking about development in agriculture, and it's sort of researchers develop the technology, do experiments in the communities, and then sort of transfer that knowledge to farmers. And the idea of campesino a campesino, which is the farmer-to-farmer program, is that the farmers actually already have a lot of knowledge of themselves, and particularly collectively have a lot of knowledge. They've been growing and working on corn and beans for a really, really long time. And the idea is that it also builds community leadership. So if someone has a solution to a pest problem, for example, they come together in a workshop style setting, and sort of it's more of a popular education methodology, and share with their peers. There's quite a bit written on this, and it's been happening, like I said, for a long time. In Nicaragua, there's just to give you an idea of what it looks like on the ground. In Nicaragua, there's one coordinator throughout for the entire country that coordinates different workshops in different areas, and it's very region specific, very context specific. So the idea, actually, I think I have it on the next slide. Yeah, okay, so this is, I was really lucky to get to participate in one of the workshops, the former Campesino a Campesino. And on the left is, there. It's pretty much all farmers, there's not too many outside besides me, sort of in the corner, mostly observing what was going on. And so the idea is they get together and the one coordinator for the country sort of starts things off, and he passes out sort of an overview agenda and strategies for reaching the goals of the workshop, and then he hands it off, essentially sort of gets it rolling, and then hands it off to different participants, and that's sort of when the leadership role begins. The idea is then that farmers take that workshop agenda and start to get, if they're bought into it and they think it works, they can also hold workshops in their own communities. And I can say by the end of this particular workshop, farmers were really, really excited about doing just that. So what we did is we broke out into different groups, depending on if you're interested more in corn or beans or soy. And they basically, four or five farmers got together and talked about what sort of issues that came up with their crop over that particular season and how they dealt with it, how their neighbors dealt with it, sort of what were some solutions that they came up with. So it was very sort of localized knowledge share. And then we went out, one person from the group presented. The guy standing up there is presenting, this is what we did for the corn infestation, and this is what we did for the cotton, etc. And then we went outside, the picture on the right, and this is, we were talking about seed selection and seed saving and how do you choose the best seed to save so you get the strongest, most robust, most abundant crop the next year. And so we basically went out in a in one of the farmers' land and collectively decided which corn would be best to save seed from. So they wouldn't eat that, but they would that particular crop, but they would save it to plant next year. And it was, you know, I learned a lot. It definitely, and I did get the sense though that most farmers, especially collectively, really kind of knew how to do this already, but it maybe wasn't on the fore of their strategies or methods for replanting or whatever. So I guess briefly, some of the issues that this model hopes to address, besides being farmer, in many ways farmer-led, is the idea when there's an agronomist or a technician present as a key factor in these sorts of projects, it tends to put farmers in a passive role. And also the number of farmers that get reached by this new technology that's being brought in depends on how many people the technician can actually visit in a certain period of time. And they work directly with each farmer. So some of the research and what I saw myself points to there's not much catalyzation among farmers and the typical agronomist or technician and farmer relationship. It also addresses the issue of short-term NGO budgets. So oftentimes, and I've seen this time and time again, when the budget runs out for a project like Home Gardens, for example, which I saw this a bunch, it basically, things revert back to pre-project state. So, the funding's gone, the project ends, it's sort of done. And then rather than bringing in outside knowledge, sort of presuming ignorance in some ways by the farmers, the idea is that the extensionist has a new role of facilitating and supporting the process of farmer exchanges. Oh, no, go back. Okay, so. Okay, so, I missed the best part. Okay, so, we'll come back to that. My final products I'm writing my master's thesis on this, but more tangible things that I'll pass off to the partners. First of all, I didn't mention that I worked with a research assistant in Nicaragua. She was a college student. She was part of an internship that the local NGO, internship program that the local NGO facilitated. They have interns in and out that do, I say in and out, but I think it's actually like a two-year cycle or something where they get trained, not only on administrative things, but also on doing sustainable community development. And I have to say that it was one of the most rewarding things that I did working with her, because we learned so much from each other. And in the end, we were asked by the NGO director to develop a manual on how to do in-depth interviews. Because one of the things that they want to develop within the internship program is a way for students to do research in their own country, and sort of as a part of one of the NGO projects. So, her and I worked together and developed a methodologies for doing in-depth interviewing, and we went to the library together. We got all these methods books, sociological methods books in Spanish, and worked on it together. And I trained her to do initially before that. I trained her to do the how to do interviews, and it was really interesting because I've worked in the past with college students on sort of experiential learning, and she was just great. You know, she like had all these different perspectives that I never would have thought of. And I tried different ways to make it an empowering experience for her, because she was reflecting on her own socio-political historical situation in a way, because she comes from a farming community. And so that, for me, was also very rewarding. I did an exit presentation and report that basically shared my preliminary findings with the project team, project management team, the NGO, and Second Little Co-op, and some other people. And I later learned that they did actually reference my research in some decision-making situations, which was sort of validating. Like, wow, I actually did something useful. And then I'm still working on a final findings report, which will come out of probably my thesis once I do sort of more in-depth analysis. And I'll pass that off to them as well. So now back to it. One of the things I've learned over the years of working with people in Central America is like it's really important to balance these really intense, big, deep issues with dancing and going out and singing karaoke in Spanish. So this is sort of ode to that. So just to sort of pull it all together. I started talking about climate change and how we, you know, and it's sort of like this idea of climate change governance and adapting and creating resilience around climate change is, it's not necessarily new, but it is sort of, you know, we're still figuring out how to deal with it. It's sort of a new, new topic in international institutions. But what I'm finding is like the issues of collaboration on the ground with communities and preparing for these strategies sort of still remains steeped in the decade-old problems of participation and community organization. So there's been plenty of research sort of done on like biodiverse farming methods. And how to make farming methods more resilient to disaster and climate change, which is really important and really necessary. But I think what's also important is fundamental. It's a question of sort of social organization, international collaborations, because you know none of that's going to make work if there isn't an organization and collaboration. So, I guess. This is where I'm ready for questions and any feedback, because I'm still actually developing my outline, which was supposed to be due a few days ago. outline for my thesis. So if you do have any feedback, I'm really open to it. And I really, yeah, thanks.
All right. So any questions or feedback to Carrie?
Yes, Karen.
Great presentation. It's been cool work. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more on the type of people who are participating in the Farmer to Farmer program. Like, have you noticed there a certain ethnicity or like economic background?
I guess I can mostly speak to my experience, to the workshop that I went to, and I, you know, it was an all-day workshop, and I can't really tell you sort of, you know, they're Nicaraguans. I couldn't tell you their sort of background in terms of connection with indigenous bloodlines and stuff like that, which I assume there's definitely some there. I would say they're certainly not necessarily like large scale farmers. It's most likely going to be a more smaller scale farmer initiative. Although I will say one of the guys in the picture used to run a large scale farm, and after learning about the Farmer to Farmer Exchange and going to some workshops, he actually changed his methods and did more small-scale biodiverse setup because he found, you know, he was basically in place of the knowledge and traditional methods, he was replacing that with inputs, so chemical inputs and stuff like that. And he was like, well, shoot, if I don't have to do that, why don't I, you know, just do it this other way? It's a connection with community as well as economically not having to buy the inputs and whatnot.
I was wondering how the locations were chosen. There's a coordinator, and then just curious about, you know, how they choose locations, is, you know, and the people that they're going to work with to do the farmer program.
Oh, the farmer to farmer program?
Yes.
So that depends. my understanding of it is that there are national conferences as well as visits to certain sites, but it has to be, so I think this one they mentioned was sort of fostered out of a national conference, where a national farmer to farmer exchange conference, where someone went from that community and got excited about it and contacted that one coordinator that I mentioned and organized that exchange to happen. So they won't go into communities and be like, hey, do you want to do this? They're very adamant about the people in the community asking for it. Yeah, that's really important. Thanks for pointing that out. Yes, Kelsey?
But you briefly mentioned who earlier in your presentation, who says farmers actually even want food sovereignty? Mm-hmm. What was your impression on the ground of understanding of the difference between food security and food sovereignty?
That's a great question. The difference is I heard the term food security a lot from farmers. They're like, yeah, you know, we need to have enough food and food security, home gardens and food security. And I didn't actually hear the term sovereignty, which doesn't mean that it's not thought about in different terms, which is important to consider, right? So through my interactions with farmers and sort of like people asking for seeds and asking for different things from me and sort of expecting the project to kind of take care of things and, you know, we'll do the project if we get the stuff, and it made me think that, you know, it's at least not within their discourse of thinking that way in food sovereign terms. You know, it's not in their realm of understanding. But then when I go to places like the workshop, the farmer and farmer exchange in a different community, which is not one that I interviewed, that's all they're talking about. You know, it's sort of, how do we save our own seeds? How do we work together to, you know, problem shoot these different like pests or whatever in their on their farm. So, did I answer your question? Did you have a question, Jessica?
Yeah. When you presented your findings to the NGOs,
I didn't mention that.
Yeah, like what was their response to your reflections?
Yeah, so I got great feedback from some people, and then others, and this was sort of, you know, I was worried about, like the NGO director, for example, who had initially asked, you know, why don't farmers just change and do this and that, and then also some of the other people associated with the second level co-op were sort of like, good job, you know, like that's great, and it wasn't really taken, at least by some people, as very seriously. I think there's something in there, you know, there is this idea of, I could envision, you know, there is this sense, maybe by pointing out these different issues, that that there could be a fear of loss of some level of power in the in the process. And so it's weird because I sort of got hot and cold from them, and I'm not sure they knew exactly how to deal with it. And I mean, I had great rapport with everyone on the management team. We hung out and talked and philosophized, but that's really important too, so that, you know, they do take you more seriously and you have that relationship. But it'll have to come from many different sides, I think. You know, like this one piece of research isn't going to change, you know, the way they view development. But I do think it's a good sort of snapshot. So.
Yeah, Kelly and Pete, if you don't mind, Pete, let Kelly go first.
Sure.
So you were talking, you know, towards the beginning about another competitiveness that people still want to do something like raise coffee and use that one to describe things.
Right.
Which sounded a lot like what we do to me. So I was wondering, like, relative to Nicaragua or I guess the rest of the world, how is the United States doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really important. You know, I'm talking about this far off place, Nicaragua, and this big thing, food sovereignty, but it's an international, worldwide agenda that, you know, people all over the world are trying to make moves towards. I think it's manifested mostly, you see it in sort of small scale local farming operations. Like I know around, there's different ways that, like CSAs, for example, or even, I guess, people that are using sort of the, did you want to add?
Well,
yeah,
I just
do
wanted
it.
To mention that Sedgwick, Maine is just a small little town, but everyone, maybe 4,000 people in this town, but everyone went to city council like 2 years ago and they all voted for food sovereignty. So now everything that they eat in the town has to be grown there. And it's basically just a trade and barter system. And I don't know if they still have it because the USDA is probably fighting back. But when I was there in August, they were food sovereign for 2 years at that point. So.
There are different international organizations like La Via Campesina, which has pushes a food sovereignty agenda, which has international farming organizations from all over the world that are sort of fighting in different ways or promoting different alternatives for food sovereignty. I guess that's a good example, and I think it is happening in different ways. In the U.S. as well, and it's just interesting too to think about how these different actions and moves that people are taking towards the food sovereignty agenda impact the international world, right? So if farmers decide we're going to grow less coffee or less bananas, you know, what does that mean for people like us who consume that? And I think it's a really good question. So
let's let Pete wrap it up.
I really like that presentation.
It starts out positive.
I thought it was really interesting and appropriate how you sort of move toward the discussion of PAR as an alternative to traditional development and the example of Rama Campesino Campesino. So I ask you this, do you think the farmers in this area need food sovereignty? Mm-hmm.
I think you'd have to ask them that.
Okay, so what if they did get together in a PAR context and they decided, well, no, we don't want food sovereignty. We have
exactly.
to receive seeds and mm-hmm. you know, do what we're doing.
Yeah.
So what do you do with that? What about your experience and your training and your 8 years with CAN and mm-hmm. your understanding of the larger mm-hmm. context of climate change?
You're asking for an answer?
Yeah.
Well, that's a really good question because it's Is that the one you're going to ask me at my thesis defense?
So you can see the trauma.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would be sort of if they decided they didn't want to participate in a specific food sovereignty agenda, that would, in a way, be a food sovereignty decision. I mean, they're sort of, it's the core of food sovereignty that I am grabbing onto, especially for my research, is that it is a choice. So if they're choosing not to, for whatever reason.
So that decision will be more legitimate than one arrived at through resistance to top down the traditional discourse.
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
No, I think you just gave me one.
Yeah.
Wow, that was a hard wrap-up question.
I knew it was